Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Stephen Watts, who is the author of a new book, a new biography of Will Rogers. It's called Citizen Cowboy, Will Rogers and the American People. It's out now. If you're interested in what you hear today, you can go pick it up at Amazon or wherever books are sold. So thank you for being on the show today, Stephen. I appreciate it.
I'm delighted to be with you.
So I have a confession to make. When I asked for a copy of the book, I had in my head confused Will Rogers and Roy Rogers. They're both cowboy types, but obviously very, very different. So when I started reading, I was a little confused. I was like, oh yes, Will Rogers, right, Will Rogers, not Roy Rogers. But he's an immensely interesting figure in terms of tracking the evolution of America, without being too dramatic about it, America as an idea or an idea of itself, as well as the evolution of mass media in general, the introduction of mass media, the kind of creation of it. I'm really glad to have you on today because I think he's just a really interesting figure here. And then on top of that, there's all the political stuff. We can discuss that. But fill folks in who may, like me, not be entirely familiar with Will Rogers as they get started reading this. Who was Will Rogers, and how did he burst onto the scene?
Happy to do it. Will Rogers actually was a Cherokee Indian. His family is a very prominent Cherokee family in the Oklahoma Territory in the 19th century. He was born in 1879, and he burst on the scene right around the turn of the century as a young man. He had become very interested. It came from a cowboy background, a kind of genuine cowboy ranching background. And he was an expert lariat thrower, and he entered into rodeos and cowboy shows as a lariat artist. And from there, he began to sort of branch out into different areas of entertainment. He ended up in vaudeville, the Ziegfeld Follies eventually, Broadway shows eventually, silent movies, talkie movies. But also, as he advanced as a humorist, many people sort of described him as the 20th century's Mark Twain. As a humorist, he was so popular that he also got a syndicated newspaper column that was carried in about 300 newspapers around the country, wrote magazine articles, et cetera, et cetera. So practically every media form that's emerging in the early 20th century, Will Rogers was there as a kind of humorous entertainer, became wildly popular. I think probably the most beloved man in America in the late teens, 1920s, the early 1930s. So that's kind of a thumbnail sketch of Rogers arriving on the scene.
Yeah, and again, it's fascinating because he's here at this moment, not just when newspapers are becoming a little more national, but also when the wire services kick in. He's one of the first film stars. He's a huge presence on radio. Again, it's just a really interesting guy. But he also hits the kind of American idea of itself. And I just want to read a passage from the book because I think it's very telling about how Rogers himself saw America and Americans and kind of what he was bringing across, right? So this is from a 1925 column. He declared, his faith in America's big, honest majority. The typical average citizen, Rogers insisted, quote, is not 100% American. He is not any organization, either uplift or downfall, but an animal that has been going along believing in right, doing right, tending to his own business, letting the other fellows alone. He is just normal. End quote. What does that, how does that reflect the prevailing ideas of the time that Americans held about themselves and their fellows?
Well, I think that description you just read was actually one of my favorites, too, for understanding Rogers. As I argue in the book, I think he touched upon a kind of powerful populist strain in American society and culture, a kind of faith in ordinary, workaday, what he called normal Americans, who lived in their neighborhoods, wanted their families to do well and worked hard to that end, probably went to church, just sort of regular folks. And Rogers believed that such people were the backbone of the United States and American values. And this is a kind of a tradition, I think, that goes back, really, in certain ways, the founding of the country. You see certain aspects of that with Jeffersonian ideology, certainly with Jackson and company, and then a little later with the populist movement itself. But Rogers was very, very attuned to ordinary Americans. And I think that big, honest majority of normal people you describe, they were his lodestar, I think, for everything he wrote, everything he evaluated, what he said about politics and entertainment and social trends and the like. That's where his heart was, I think, from the beginning to the end of his career. And it's really a key to, I think, why common folk loved the guy so much.
Let's talk about his actual act, because it's interesting hearing the evolution of it. You know, he particularly when he was, you know, kind of introduced to the stage, when he's on stage and he starts adding in political commentary, but mostly in a humorous sort of vein. Can you tell folks a little bit about what his act was, what his performances were like, and how he sprinkled in common sense, folksy humor, almost Dave Barry-ish is how I think of it when I was reading. What the act was like. Right. What was he doing to get audiences on his side?
Well, when Rogers got into vaudeville, and even later in the Ziegfeld Follies, where he sort of played, he was the against type act in the Ziegfeld Follies. He's very urban, sophisticated kind of entertainment. He originally started as really just a cowboy entertainer with the lariat. And his shtick in the early going was he had a live horse on stage and he would do all of these wonderful rope tricks. He was really astonishing. Some of it's on film with how adept he was using a lariat to perform all of these tricks. And almost by accident, if he would miss a trick with the rope in the early going, he made a wisecrack and the audience laughed and sort of grew from there, where he discovered that those laughs he could get by missing a trick on purpose. Then he began to write sort of jokes and cracks about his mistakes. And from there, it sort of segued into sort of humorous commentary, and it just broadened almost year by year. He would do research about the towns he went into, for example, in vaudeville, and he would make sort of humorous comments about the local political scene or the mayor being run out of office or the local scandals or whatever. And his reputation and his skill both sort of grew apace, I think, all the way through the late aughts and the 19-teens. And pretty soon the humor became the vehicle for Will Rogers. The cowboy stuff was sort of to the side, whereas it had begun quite the opposite. But by the late 19-teens, his humor was becoming a kind of national phenomenon. People just loved it. He really was witty and talented, and he had these kind of mechanisms, sort of personal quirks, folksy kinds of things where he would sort of scratch the back of his head and push his cowboy hat and look perplexed and adopt this kind of country boy goes to the city kind of thing where I don't quite know what's going on, but then he'd make these very shrewd observations and funny. So that kind of became the Will Rogers that everyone grew to love in this period.
And that is, also kind of the defining idea of America at this time, a move away from the more agrarian, farming, based society to a more industrial, city-based, manufacturing-based. I mean, he really does kind of straddle these two worlds and ideas of America itself.
Well, we historians, and I am a historian of American culture, for a long time have described the late 19th and the early 20th century as being a great watershed in American history, really kind of a decisive move away from the rural republic of the 1800s to the kind of urban industrialized consumer economy of the 20th. And what I began to notice early on when I was researching Rogers and sort of digging into the guy was the way in which so much of his commentary, as you just noted, sort of straddled that fault line from one to the other, sort of making fun of the past a little bit, but also honoring the past in certain ways. And the same thing with the present, sort of criticizing in certain ways this new society of golf players and Model T automobiles and the like that seems so silly in other kinds of ways. So you see him kind of tiptoeing along that fault line, I think, between the past and the emerging present. And I became very convinced, and in the book, as you know, I really argue this a lot, it's the way he mediates between those two sides of history, I think, that really was the key. He helped people negotiate a great historical change, and I think they loved him for it.
Yeah, no, for sure. I just want to read this. I want to read a passage, your description of the Ziegfeld Follies and also the man who put it together, Ziegfeld himself. Here's your writing quote. He had an instinctive feel for an audience abandoning Victorian verites and the changing cultural milieu of the early 20th century. In a new age, countless citizens were exchanging the work ethic for the leisure ethic, character for personality, scarcity for abundance, and self-control for self-fulfillment, end quote. And it's interesting because Rogers himself embodies that idea a little bit, but he kept, I've rarely read about a figure in cultural history who worked as hard or as steadily as he did throughout his career. I mean, just the keeping track of everything he was up to at any given time must have taken, I frankly, just from a writing perspective, from your POV, keeping track of all the things, all the plates he had spinning must have been a real difficulty.
Yeah, you're right. And I mean, his career was truly astonishing. It's hard to think of anyone else who had his finger in so many pies with media, new kinds of entertainment, new kinds of expression with writing and the radio and movies and stage shows and on and on and on. And he's so interesting to me because of the way he did have one foot in the past and one in the future. He is traveling all of these tributaries of this new media, entertainment, celebrity culture. But you have to remember he was doing so dressed in chaps and a cowboy hat and all the regalia of an age that's vanishing into the past. So it almost literally he has one foot in the present and future and one foot in the past. And I think what he gets across to people in certain ways is that sort of going from one to the other might not be quite as wrenching or not quite as dislocating as you may think sometimes that you could sort of accommodate one to the other. And I think that was his gift as a humorist and as an entertainer.
Now, he one of the things you write a bit about in this book is his relationship with politics. And, you know, of course, as a columnist, he was frequently delving into the political topics of the day and also the political personalities of the day. What was his relationship to electoral politics? You know, you say the word populist, and that means that can mean any number of different things, you know, today from looking back or compared to today, whatever. But it's interesting to read about his relationship to politics and politicians, because he clearly has a kind of ideological sense of America in terms of what he thinks the average American is and what the average American wants. And yet he seems to get along with virtually every politician he runs into. He's not a particularly partisan figure, at least in my reading. Is that more or less right?
Well, I think that is more or less right. I think what Rogers got into pretty quickly in his commentary was poking fun, but it was usually sort of good-natured fun at the misfires of American politics and how politics as usual worked. He delighted in writing columns about sort of the dysfunction of the American Congress, for example, and sort of poking fun about the hypocrisies and the shameless kind of interest grubbing and the kind of stupid arguments that often dominated Congress. And being a very witty guy, he made some great jokes about that when Congress opened one time, for example, after a particularly egregiously bad session. He said that all Americans should fall to their knees and sort of recite this prayer and say, "Oh God, help us all, because they know not what they do. Amen." But as you noted, he was also very nonpartisan. Rogers, I think, saw both parties as having sort of good parts and bad parts, that people were trying their best, even when he made fun of them. He was friends with Calvin Coolidge and even Warren Harding, but he was also great friends with Franklin Roosevelt, and he tried to kind of steer a nonpartisan course, I think. And the one thing I kept coming back to in my discussion of his politics was civility. Politics for Rogers was serious, but it wasn't a blood sport. It was a kind of thing where you could be critical, but you also needed to be sort of magnanimous in judging people's actions and not get crazy and politicizing everything. He insisted that people on either side of the party divide were opponents. They weren't enemies. And a favorite saying he often brought forward in his political writing said, "When you see a political opponent, don't confront him by looking right at him, but step around behind him and look at things the way he's looking at them before you engage in conversation." And I think in a way that kind of sums up, I think, his very, to my mind anyway, broad-minded and civil attitude toward the political scene.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because without sounding cynical myself, I would say there's a cynical way of looking at this, right? Which is to say, well, he doesn't want to offend anyone on any side because everybody, you know, everyone's a potential customer. You don't want to lose, you don't want to lose that sort of thing. But again, the thing I was struck by most reading your book was that he did seem to have a genuinely friendly relationship with all of these politicians. He seemed to be the sort of person who just liked people, which, you know, is not always the sort you find is certainly in the journalism realm, but certainly in the columnist realm, but also not really in the political realm.
Well, you're right. And I think one of the striking things about Rogers was he did like people. And somebody got on him once, for example, when he was making fun of some political figure. And he responded in the next column, and he wrote something like, I've made fun of just about every big political figure in both parties in my writing. But what I want to have chiseled on my gravestone is I never met a man I didn't like. And indeed, that is what is on his gravestone. And I think it was more or less authentic. I think Rogers liked people. He gave people a lot of benefit of the doubt. And I think he believed that people make mistakes, as we all do. But again, you can criticize him for that, but they're not enemies. They're opponents in the worst reading, and that's how you would approach it. So I think it was, there might have been a slight bit of cynicism in that he didn't mind making a buck and he didn't want to alienate people. But at the same time, I think that was his genuine attitude toward the political scene.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You won't see the engineer that slams the Nissan Rogue's door 13,920 times, or the corrosive chamber that simulates 15 years of life in 5 months, or the Rogue heat-baked for over 300 combined hours. What you will see is a vehicle that can take punch after punch and keep rolling. Nissan, number one in new vehicle quality among mainstream brands by J.D. Power. We put it through the worst so you get its best. For J.D. Power 2025 U.S. initial quality study award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Awards based on 2025 model year. Newer models may be shown.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about, there's one story in particular that's very funny. And I had never heard before. I feel like this should be a bigger sort of story alongside the Orson Welles War of the Worlds broadcast for moments of mass media confusion. So there's right. a moment here. I'll actually let you tell the story. So I'll just set the scene here. He has been called to do a radio show about, I can't remember the exact contents here, Calvin Coolidge. What did he do that caused so much confusion in America?
Rogers apparently was a very good mimic, and he was set up to introduce Calvin Coolidge, or it was set up as him introducing Coolidge, supposedly, in this broadcast radio by late 20s, or mid-20s, I guess it was. And what he did was to imitate Calvin Coolidge and make this utterly nonsensical political speech in the voice of Calvin Coolidge. And he was so good at it that listeners were utterly convinced it was Calvin Coolidge just saying these long string of non sequiturs and sort of idiotic half statements, none of which made any sense. But it was very, very amusing. It sort of made Coolidge look very foolish. So it was a great success sort of immediately, but then there was a huge backlash to this almost as soon as he went off the air, and that people, particularly who like Coolidge, when they sort of discerned what was going on, and they really went after Rogers for being disrespectful to the president and faking his identity and, making Coolidge look like an idiot, etc., etc. And Rogers was absolutely mortified because he had just done it all as a big joke. And he was so mortified that he actually wrote Mr. and Mrs. Coolidge a letter because he had spent the night at the White House with them and he considered them to be friends. And he just apologized profusely and said, I'm just a joke maker and I didn't mean to embarrass you. I didn't mean to create this stink in the radio waves here. And Coolidge wrote a very gracious thing back to him and said, well, I didn't really take the whole thing very seriously. But it was kind of an early Orson Welles type of thing is, what the hell is going on here in the media?
Yeah. And it's sometimes hard to discern these things. These were not the highest quality radio broadcasts necessarily. The sound quality was not, and it's not like anybody necessarily knew what Coolidge sounded like to begin with. Exactly. You know, it's fascinating to think about.
Yeah, you can never pull that off now, I think, but in the early days of the media, that a lot easier.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. The new AI technologies that we have, well, the new, you know, voice spoofing, and that's, I feel like we could be seeing a real return to that sort of thing.
Fair enough.
In the next few years, although probably more maliciously minded than Rogers had intended. Let's talk a little bit about your research for this book, because I was reading this and it struck me that I assume there are no recordings of this.
Of the Coolidge thing?
Of the Coolidge thing.
Not that I know of. There are a fair number of radio recordings that they have down at the Will Rogers Memorial Museum, mm-hmm. but I don't believe that's one of them.
Okay.
But there are others.
Yeah, so this is what I wanted to discuss a little bit, is because this is such an explosion of media. I mean, he has column, he has radio show, there are silent films, which I don't know if they all survive or if some have been lost, and then there are the talkies, which I think mostly survive. Were there any frustrations on your part when you were trying to track down things that you wanted to read about that you had read secondhand or from secondary sources? Were there primary sources you wanted to examine but couldn't just get a hold of because they don't exist anymore?
Not too many. Actually, I was very lucky. There's an abundance of material out there. Rogers' writings have been published in, I think it's like 8 or 10 volume series. So they're voluminous with all his newspaper, magazine stuff. His papers have also been published in a multi-volume series as well. So that stuff's all available. And then there's tons of stuff that was written about Rogers during his lifetime. He was such a popular figure. He was much written about in newspapers and magazines. So it wasn't too hard digging that stuff up. But a lot of materials down at the Will Rogers Memorial Museum in Claremore, Oklahoma, where they have a lot of his original papers are on file there. And they have scrapbooks that were there saved by Rogers and friends of the Rogers family and the like. So I would go down there for several extended stays, digging into all that stuff. So the only real stuff that I struggled with just a bit were the silent movies. I think he made, if memory serves, about 19 of those. And I think about half of them have survived. They have a number of the originals at the Claremore Museum. And then I think over the years, two or three of them have popped up. You know, they found them in odd places in Los Angeles or whatever. But about half of them, they still don't have. And they have photographs that were taken during the filming of the movies and the sheets with the dialogue that was printed on the screen and the like, and some reminiscences of people who were there. But some of the movies themselves have just disappeared. But other than that, I had really good luck with primary source stuff.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. You mentioned the folks who wrote about Rogers when he was alive about his writings and other activities, and they weren't always positive. I think in particular, The Nation magazine was fairly critical. I remember you mentioned A.G. had written negatively. Mm-hmm. About him, what was the knock on Will Rogers from folks who were less enamored of his folksy populism than the majority of the country?
Well, I would say that the critics of Rogers were in a very strong minority as far as contemporaneous criticism went, but they were fairly outspoken, the ones who did criticize him. Basically, what most of them said is that Will Rogers was kind of a fraud, that this was all an act, and that Rogers was sort of playing the cowboy, that he was playing the country guy going to the city, that all of his humor, his persona, all of this was just a big put on to tell jokes and make money and become a popular entertainer. And James Agee, for example, was one of those, and he went after Rogers very hard along these lines. And a few others did as well, mostly in sort of left-leaning journals of opinion, political opinion in particular. They weren't terribly keen on Rogers. They thought he was kind of a fake populist. And they criticized, for example, his friendship with Coolidge and Harding and Herbert Hoover and the like, and his friendship with Henry Ford and whatever, along those lines. So that was the vein of criticism that usually was followed by the minority of critics.
Mm. And then there's a funny passage here in which H.L. Mencken goes after him, though the two seem to be friends from what I remember reading. Yes, they were friendly.
Indeed.
But there is a funny passage. I just want to read this real quick. So this is Mencken, quote, "Look at the man. He alters foreign policies. He makes and unmakes candidates. He destroys public figures by deriding Congress and undermining its prestige. He has virtually reduced us to a monarchy. Millions of Americans read his words daily, and those who are unable to read listen to him over the radio. I consider him the most dangerous writer alive today," end quote. And this is a joke, obviously, and the two of them are friendly and having fun here. But there is a darker strain to this idea of the kind of populist rabble rouser. You see it in the movie starring Andy Griffith, A Face in the Crowd. I don't know if you've seen A Face in the Crowd, but you know that character is kind of based on the Will Rogers archetype of a populist truth speaker who whips up the mob and demagogues them into a dangerous place. And it is it's interesting to kind of think about the power that this sort of individual has or can have and can influence the public with.
Well, that was kind of vintage Mencken, I think. It was at one of the Republican conventions and an after-hours drinking session with a bunch of journalists. And Mencken had that outburst. The very end of it, if I can put the icing on the cake here, was Rogers was there and he said, oh, Mencken, you're exaggerating. He said, nobody really takes all my political writings all that seriously. And Mencken says, Roger says, rather, no one with any brains takes them very seriously. And Mencken comes back and says, well, that, of course, defines 80% of the American population who take you seriously. So Mencken, we should remember for all of his flamboyant sort of counterculture stuff, was very much an elitist in the 1920s, to say the least. Well, the thing with Rogers that I think Mencken wildly exaggerated was the rabble-rousing aspect of this. Because Rogers, if you spend more than about a half hour with Rogers and reading his stuff, he's anything but a rabble-rouser. I mean, what he does is to poke fun, and usually in a very kind of gentle and folksy way. There's rarely a real edge to what he says, and he's certainly not out there sort of urging people to the ramparts or anything like that. So I take Mencken's point and your point here as well, that there is some danger to the face in the crowd kind of temptation. But if there's anyone I've ever written or read about in modern America who less fits that description, I think it's certainly not Will Rogers.
Yeah, that is certainly fair. Let's talk a little bit about his move to movies, because again, this is a movie podcast. This is that is what I spend most of my time talking about. His move into talkies, which comes right as the medium is changing, and then he dies kind of suddenly and tragically after just a short period here. But there's a quote from a from somebody in the book, I forget who, I didn't write it down, that he was a man that was made for the talkies. He was the guy that was born for that era of film. What was it about his charm and his appeal that just made him so effective on screen when you could hear him speak?
Right. Well, Rogers began his career in the silent films, as you suggested briefly, with Samuel Goldwyn and then Hal Roach. And I think he made 18 or 19 silent films, which did reasonably well, not great. And they sort of played on, many of them, on the Rogers persona, the folksy, down-home humorist. But they did not allow a critical part of his appeal, and that was his voice. To no great surprise, the silent movies silenced Rogers, and a silent Rogers was not nearly as effective as the guy who talked. So when the talkies come along in the late 20s and then on up into the early 30s, as one of the critics wrote after seeing his first talkie film, he said, talkies were invented for Will Rogers. Because what you could see full-blown, I think, even better than in the Ziegfeld Follies or Vaudeville, and certainly more than in the silent films, was sort of the fully rounded humorous figure and commentator in these talky films. And the Rogers, who was the kind of down-home figure from rural village America, could sort of appear full-blown, not only with the mannerisms, but with the voice and that kind of drawling, hesitant, but very sharp verbal dexterity that he had as a commentator in American life. So the talkies just were a wonderful instrument, I think, for his persona to shine in the films. And I had not been aware of this at all when I began this book. By the early 1930s, Will Rogers was one of the two or three best office-drawing movie stars in Hollywood. And in one year, it was either 33 or 34, according to the surveys, I think it was like the Motion Picture Herald, he was the top-drawing movie star in the country over people like Mae West and Clark Gable and Gary Cooper and the like. So the movies were a big part of his appeal to people out there in the country.
Yeah, yeah. All right, that was pretty much everything I wanted to ask you. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if you think there's something folks should know about Will Rogers or this period in American history writ large, pretty much anything. What should we have discussed that we did not get a chance to?
Well, one thing I guess I always stress, I've written a number of books about cultural figures in the modern period, Walt Disney and Henry Ford, Hugh Hefner and Dale Carnegie and the like, as well as Will Rogers. One thing I always try to get people to think about is that when you write about somebody like this, you want to look at not only what they made, but what was made of them. And to try to get a handle on sort of the reception of these people. How did people out there, the consumers, the viewers of movies, the readers of newspaper columns, the other critics, whatever, what did they make of this guy? And I think when you consider that, you get a much more fully rounded picture of someone and how they actually act and had influence in a real life historical context. So I guess I would urge anyone who wants to engage with Will Rogers to look at what was made of him as well as what he made.
Hmm. Do you have anything in particular that you would recommend, folks?
Well, other than my book, other than my book, I think it's so. If you have the time, I think reading some of his newspaper writing directly would give you a really good flavor for what he was like and what he was saying, and sort of the style in which he wrote these things. Get a glimpse of the real guy there behind the words. So it's always fun and illuminating to dip into the primary stuff. So read some of his newspaper columns. I think. That would be a good idea.
Yeah. All right. Again, the name of the book is Citizen Cowboy, Will Rogers and the American People. I've been talking to Stephen Watts here. Thanks for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Great to talk with you. I enjoyed it.
My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.